In the post-war years, a string of unexplained sightings in the skies over Britain helped fuel a growing fixation with aliens and UFOs. Officially, Whitehall always denied any interest, but new evidence has revealed that there was, in fact, a series of top-secret investigations into the reports. Jerry Northam has been examining Britain's X-Files.
Ceiling control, Oscar Sierra is ready for departure.
Oscar Sierra, receiving radio, there's no known traffic.
In his mid-70s, retired Air Commodore Michael Swinney is back at the controls and ready for takeoff. 50 years ago, as an instructor at the RAF Central Flying School, Michael Swinney took off with a trainee on a flight which was to prove the most memorable of his long career.
We broke through some cloud at about 14,000 feet, and in front of the aircraft there appeared to be three people coming down in parachutes. So I grabbed the control of the aircraft from the student to make sure that if there were parachutes we didn't go through the middle of them. But it was soon quite apparent that they weren't, but there were three circular white or off-white discs straight in front of me, two on a level keel and one very slightly canted to one side. We continued climbing until they lost their disc appearance and took on a sort of flat plate.
Michael Swinney is not given to flights of fancy and has seen nothing like this before or since. He knew that other pilots would be sceptical, even scornful, of his sighting. But he remains adamant that it was real.
We tried very hard to explain away what we were looking at, but there's no way we could do that. There was something there, there's absolutely no doubt about it. I did subsequently feel that we were looking at something that really we shouldn't be seeing. And I remember being told on landing that I looked fairly shaken, almost as if I'd seen a ghost.
Michael Swinney's story of this strange sighting is confirmed by his colleague in the Meteor, Lieutenant Commander David Crofts of the Royal Navy, who looked up from his instruments and saw the three flying objects ahead. When the two officers landed, they made notes in their logbooks, David Crofts illustrating his with a little drawing of the three saucers in formation.
There were a couple of officers from the Air Ministry who debriefed us. They told us they had been onto every country in the world that was likely to have that sort of aircraft in the vicinity at that time, and they all agreed that they didn't. They did say that they had been picked up by Sockley radar, that the fighters had been alerted and scrambled, and that the target had a ground speed of 600 miles an hour, perhaps, heading east, but that the fighters saw nothing, didn't make a contact. But it was gratifying to know that they'd been picked up on radar, that I wasn't a complete idiot seeing things.
I do not know what I saw. I will probably never know what I saw, but for sure I saw something. I have an open mind. I don't think there's any way that it can be terrestrial, but at the same time, I simply don't know if other beings are around, and if that's what David Crofts and I saw.
Would you rather, in your heart of hearts, would you rather that the explanation turned out to be terrestrial or extraterrestrial?
I think probably I'd prefer somebody to come up and say, we've explained it away, they were very secret aircraft at the time, but I don't know. I rather doubt that.
By the time of this sighting in late 1952, the Air Ministry had grown accustomed to stories of close encounters from some of its most highly trained airmen. During the war, there were sightings of mysterious lights called Foo Fighters. Then there were ghost planes. And from 1947 onwards, there were flying saucers. One of the clearest reports came one morning at the Royal Aircraft Establishment Farnborough in August 1950, where an experienced test pilot, Stan Hubbard, was walking across the airfield and heard a strange sound.
It was a low-pitched, humming, hissing noise. I stopped and turned round to see what it could be. and I saw a very, very strange object coming from the direction of Basingstoke. I can only describe it as being the edge-on view of something shaped like the old sports discus we used to throw. It was a pearly sort of grey, a shimmering colour. And round the edge, there was a band of a darker colour. It appeared to be crackling and sparking. It gave the impression that there was something moving on it.
The following month, September 1950, Stan Hubbard had another weird sighting, this one more distant. For this, he wasn't alone. He was on a watchtower at Farnborough with five other officers. They all confirmed the report, and in great secrecy, the Air Ministry interviewed them all. But officials were unconvinced. Wing Commander Hubbard's first sighting, the one directly overhead, was simply disbelieved.
We conclude either that he was the victim of an optical illusion or that he observed some quite normal type of aircraft and deceived himself about its shape and speed.
And the accounts by Stan Hubbard and five other officers of a second sighting fare little better.
We conclude that the officers in fact saw some quite normal aircraft manoeuvring at extreme visual range and were led by the previous report to believe it to be something abnormal, an interesting example of one report inducing another.
Absolute rubbish. I'm not given to deceiving myself, nor am I given to not reporting what I've seen accurately. I was at the time a trained test pilot, trained specifically to report objectively and accurately about phenomena that I was experiencing or seeing. My engineering training and experience convinces me that it certainly was not from this earth. We do not have the technology capable of that sort of performance.
There's perhaps a suggestion in this report that the six of you cooked this story up together.
It is not likely that serving officers would cook something up of that nature. It would be a terrific jape, but we weren't in a japing mood. It was a very serious matter to us.
For decades, believers in the paranormal have claimed that the government investigated flying saucer reports and kept its findings secret so as not to alarm the public. Now, working through declassified intelligence documents and other official records, researchers from the University of Sheffield have found that Britain does indeed have its own X-Files. They've uncovered a top-secret MOD intelligence minute from August 1950, setting up a formal flying saucer working party. They've also found its secret report of June 1951, which examines cases including those at Farnborough. These declassified files have been brought to light in research for a book by Dr. David Clark.
The MOD have always denied when they've been questioned that there was ever any official study. In fact, they denied this in Parliament when questioned in the mid-50s by an MP from Yorkshire who asked the question, have the Air Ministry or the MOD ever conducted an inquiry into flying saucers and UFOs? And the answer that came back was that there had not been any official inquiry. And yet we now know that there had been an official inquiry. In 1950, the Flying Saucer Working Party that was created by the Ministry of Defence.
How did you find that out?
We found it out by painstaking research at the Public Record Office. I was leafing through a file from 1967 on sightings reported in that year, and I came across an internal memo from Defence Intelligence. A Defence Intelligence specialist refers to retrieving intelligence files on UFOs from 1950 and 1951. Very soon after that, we actually came across a record of the creation of this working party in the Directorate of Scientific Intelligence files.
So although it was denied, they had set up a working party in 1950.
They clearly had, and the documentary evidence was there, present at the PRO. So when we questioned the MOD, we went to the records division. We were told there was no record of this report. Then we were told it's been destroyed. And then all of a sudden, after almost giving up hope that we were ever going to see this, suddenly we were told that one surviving copy had been located.
The Flying Saucer Working Party found no top-secret details of contact with aliens. It dismissed the idea, preferring mundanely terrestrial explanations. But among the public, there was a vigorous flying saucer craze. No claim seemed too ludicrous for some newspapers, and the MOD was bombarded with unsolicited accounts of sightings and contacts. These were passed to the Intelligence Division at the Air Ministry. The official in charge has recently written to the Sheffield team about his investigation. he had little patience for what he calls the flying saucer furore. And from some of the examples he cites, it's easy to see why.
An elderly lady living in Kensington reported that she had been visited by a Martian at night. He was 7 feet tall and covered in red hair. He said he had been sent to examine her water. A dental surgeon in Rickmansworth said he had established radio contact with the commander of the Venusian space fleet, who would be visiting Earth's orbit in 1990. The commander wished to negotiate a treaty between Venus and Earth.
But however risible these reports, Air Intelligence kept its interest in UFOs secret. Not to conceal how much it knew about strange phenomena in the skies, but how little.
Sunshine 1-4, this is Sky Blue. Are you receiving me?
Hello, Sky Blue. Sunshine 1-4, receiving you loud and clear.
At RAF Neatis Head, to the north of Norwich, Britain's official radar museum is now open to the public, with exhibits dating back to the Battle of Britain. The early technology in these consoles, the first line of Cold War defence in the 1950s, shows a slightly fuzzy orange sweep around the coast of Norfolk, with a couple of small banana-shaped blips to the east from approaching aircraft. Their height appears on a separate orange bar chart to the left. One night in 1956, Flight Lieutenant Freddie Wimbledon was on duty here as chief controller when he picked up an object moving mysteriously, which had already been spotted by the US Air Force and tracked to the nuclear base at Lake and Heath. The object seemed to be flying, and it was unidentified.
It was acting rather strangely, alternately going very, very fast, much faster than anything we'd ever seen before, and then suddenly stopping without any apparent slowing down. I conferred with the sector controller and said I thought we ought to scramble the battle flight, see what it was. So the battle flight was scrambled.
We were sitting in our little Venom on the pan by the runway at Water Beach, and we had the word scramble. In somewhere around a minute, we would be rolling down the runway and off the ground.
John Brady was the navigator in the first scrambled fighter. He managed to find a blurred trace on his radar screen in the plane's cockpit.
We were told to climb to 7,000 feet, and when we did that, we were handed over to the Americans at RAF Lake and Heath.
And what did you think was going on?
Well, we knew that we were going to look at something that the Americans were not terribly happy about, and we looked for it under their control. On our first run, we saw absolutely nothing and overshot, and the Americans said, well, you better turn round and we'll send you back toward it. And we flew towards it, and at a range of about 5-6 miles, I picked something up, which was quite woolly, but at about the same height as us, but was a definite contact. And we overshot again, we reported contact on it, and we came in again at it, and exactly the same thing happened. And we also saw it on the third run.
So you saw it three times?
I saw the blip three times, yes.
After chasing up and down for half an hour, John Brady and his pilot were ordered back to base. Another fighter crew took over. The ground radar controller saw the strange object head straight upward until it was out of range. Neither pilot saw the object, and it remains unexplained. But Dr. David Clark has found that reports of phantom radar images were common, often caused by meteorological anomalies. They could deceive radar controllers about the height, speed, and movement of objects, or appear to conjure craft out of thin air.
At the time when the majority of these radar trackings were occurring in the mid-50s, the radar that was then in use was of World War II vintage. It could be easily fooled. And because flying saucers were in the media and people were highly aware of the subject, if you were an RAF controller and one of these blips appeared on your screen, what would you think it was? You'd think it was some kind of unidentified flying object. And because the RAF had to know what was going on, had to investigate these things, of course aircraft were scrambled to have a look. And in a lot of cases, some of these things were picked up on the aircraft radar as well. But nothing could be seen.
But if the government had said publicly, the problem with this is the radar isn't working very well,
that wouldn't have inspired public confidence.
It certainly wouldn't have done, because radar was our first defence against the East, against the Soviets. The public was told that we had this fantastic radar system, that anything that tried to intrude, we could see it. And yes, we could, but we could also see thousands of other things that could be easily mistaken for an enemy aircraft or an enemy missile attack. And that was the subject that the British authorities were most keen to hide.
Andy Roberts, co-author of the Sheffield study, has found that Whitehall's interest in UFO reports was triggered by fear of alien invasion, not from deepest space, but from Eastern Europe.
We were at the peak of the Cold War, and for an official announcement to be that people are seeing things and we don't know what they are would have just meant that the public lost faith and confidence completely in the armed forces. The government didn't want to tell public or press we were investigating UFOs in case they were Russian technology, and then the Russians would know that we'd found out about whatever it was they were flying, which would then give them information as to what sort of radar equipment we had, what sort of planes we were flying. So there's a complex and convoluted selection of reasons why the government wanted to keep a lid on any form of flying saucer study. So it was clear that whatever the public thought of UFOs at that time, the government were treating it purely as a Cold War subject and looking into it from a point of view of the fact that what was being seen was perhaps some form of Russian secret weapon.
But there were higher tiers of the British establishment where the possibility of extraterrestrial contact was explored with enthusiasm. An unidentified sighting by two airmen in November 1953 attracted surprisingly widespread interest. First, there were interviews in the press and on BBC television.
Flying Officer Johnson and Flying Officer Smythe, and Flying Officer Johnson first, tell us exactly what had happened.
Well, the whole story began last Tuesday when we were flying in a Vampire night fighter over Kent and at 20,000 feet, and I first sighted this object. The first sighting was of a tiny pinpoint of bright light.
The publicity this sighting attracted seems to have worried the Air Ministry. The Sheffield researchers have discovered an order sent out in secret the following month warning aircrew and radar operators not to communicate with anyone other than officials about anything they saw. Terry Johnson and Jeff Smythe were the last flying officers allowed to give interviews. But for them, events took a still odder turn. They were asked to make a private report of their sighting to a representative of the royal family.
The then squadron leader, Peter Horsley, was Prince Philip's equerry. We were informed by our squadron CO that he was coming to see us to get a report on the incident for the benefit of the Duke of Edinburgh, who was very interested in flying saucers at that time. We were ushered into the CO's office, and we sat with Peter Horsley. It must have been about an hour when he asked us questions about what had happened.
What was his manner, Peter Horsley's manner?
He was very quiet, and he seemed not to be terribly interested. He was doing a job, if you like, for the Duke. He had come to us at the behest of the Duke. He was obeying the Duke's orders, if you so wish, to come down to Westmorland to find out what was happening.
He said that?
He said that, yes.
Prince Philip's equerry, Sir Peter Horsley, was a distinguished Air Force officer who had carte blanche to read UFO reports and interview aircrew. He invited people with supposed extraterrestrial experiences to Buckingham Palace to tell their stories to him and other advisers. He thought this put them under pressure to tell the truth. He said he never found a single piece of evidence that the MOD knew of a genuine alien contact kept secret from the public. He found himself put to the test one evening in 1955 in an encounter so bizarre as to strain credulity. The Royal Investigator, though, took it perfectly seriously. It happened here in Smith Street in Chelsea, an exclusive Georgian terrace down from Sloane Square. Sir Peter had been invited here by a mysterious Mrs. Markham, of whom he knew nothing. His suspicions were apparently not aroused by the fact that Markham Square is just opposite. He was here to meet an important visitor at Mrs. Markham's flat. He wasn't sure what to expect beyond the usual sherry and biscuits. In the event, he got neither. But he did spend the evening in conversation with a man he came to believe was from another world.
Mrs. Markham said, "I want you to meet my friend Mr. Janus." And I said, "How do you do?" And we sat down.
Shortly before his recent death, Sir Peter Horsley spoke to the authors of the Sheffield study. We have a verbatim transcript of what he said about his encounter with Mr. Janus.
He sat by the fire, and I couldn't really see him very well at all. He seemed about 35, 40, spoke quietly. I think I shook hands with him when I went in.
For 2 hours, Sir Peter and Mr. Janus discussed life elsewhere in the universe, the possibility of travel in space and time, contact from higher civilizations, and other mysteries. Sir Peter felt sure that Mr. Janus was not a terrestrial being.
He didn't say he was a visitor from another planet, but I had that impression. I believe he was here to observe us. I said, "It's very nice to meet you and all that, but what do you want?" He said, "I want to meet the Duke of Edinburgh." And of course that made me worry about the security side of it.
Mr. Janus was not introduced to Prince Philip, and that was the last Sir Peter Horsley saw of him. When he retraced his steps to Smith Street some days later, he found Mrs. Markham gone and the flat empty. Prince Philip was the most senior royal to show interest in 1950s UFO reports, but he was outstripped in zeal by his uncle, then a Sea Lord, Louis Mountbatten, later Chief of the Defence Staff. It's now clear that he was the most eminent instigator of the flying saucer craze.
I think my father had heard reports from commercial pilots, Air Force pilots, of these sightings, what were clearly unidentified flying objects, and it intrigued him. And he himself began to think, well, why should we assume that we are the only civilization? There could easily, perhaps, be other civilizations that are way ahead of us.
Lord Mountbatten's younger daughter, now Lady Pamela Hicks, kept a diary in 1954 when she accompanied her father on a visit to Libya, and he had lunch with King Idris.
After the endlessly polite preliminaries, my father brought the conversation round to flying saucers. The king told him that he himself had seen two of the fiery sphere kind. And also at this lunch was Sir Alec Kirkbride, the ambassador, and Glab Pasha, Colonel Glab, who'd founded the Arab Legion. And Sir Alec said that he'd seen one, and so had Glab Pasha. And the king went on to say that in the Quran, the prophet relates how a close companion of his had seen one.
A companion of Muhammad had seen one?
Yes.
And what did your father make of that?
My father was very intrigued by that because he came back and told us, he said, look, I don't know why we think all this is new. It's been going on for centuries.
Lord Mountbatten's letters in the archive from his estate at Broadlands in Hampshire reveal an active fascination with flying saucers. From 1950 onwards, the Sunday Dispatch ran a series of hyperbolic front-page reports of alien sightings, which sent its circulation soaring.
The story that may be bigger even than atom bomb wars. Flying saucers, the number one sensation of the age.
The paper's editor said he took these reports seriously and was supported by many intelligent and distinguished people. In particular,
I received a personal letter from one of the most famous men alive today. I will not give you his name, but I must ask you to accept my word that you, your family, and all your friends would certainly know of him. He is a man who commands universal respect and admiration.
It was Lord Mountbatten. Months earlier, he'd written to the editor, an old friend and colleague, encouraging him to publish UFO reports.
It seems clear that some new thing definitely exists. They are not of human agency. Presumably, they must come from some other heavenly body. Maybe it is the Shackletons or Scots of Venus or Mars who are making their first exploration of our Earth. This is a very sobering idea and will certainly introduce a new element into world history.
This evidently impressed the Sunday Dispatch, which ran increasingly graphic stories of alien craft. Lord Mountbatten even suggested to the editor that UFOs were themselves extraterrestrial beings.
We should think of the possibility of these flying saucers being not a form of aeroplane from another planet, but being the actual inhabitants of that planet. I know this sounds ridiculous, and I'm relying on you as a very old and loyal friend not to make any capital out of the fact that I have put forward such a far-fetched explanation.
In the later 50s, Lord Mountbatten grew more sceptical. Doubt seems to have set in, after a bricklayer on his estate arrived at work late, saying he'd seen a flying saucer, with a figure descending from it, wearing dark overalls and a helmet. There was a bright bluish light, and the bricklayer, Frederick Briggs, felt himself pushed to the ground by an invisible force. Lord Mountbatten took his wife and daughter Pamela to investigate.
At 8:30 in the morning, he did appear very convincing. But, of course, I suppose secretly we so hoped that it might be true that they cushioned us into believing it.
Did you believe it at the time?
My father is the enthusiast in the family, but because he was so enthusiastic, I got excited too, but really, it's the adrenaline working and the infectious enthusiasm. And alas, very soon afterwards, he realised that, in fact, it was the most marvellous excuse invented by Briggs for being very late for work. But we were very disappointed, because we still hadn't seen our flying saucer.
The bricklayer's credibility was further undermined when he reported a second close encounter in which he had telepathic communication with the alien visitor, boarded the flying saucer, and was whisked off to the pyramids and back in 10 minutes. Lord Mountbatten's disillusion seemed complete by 1957 when he replied to one UFO devotee,
"It is true that in company with most people, I took an interest in this question in the early days. But I must be honest and confess that I no longer take the same interest, and therefore it is not worth your while sending me any further reports."
The official flying saucer working party was quietly dissolved by MOD intelligence on the 19th of June 1951. But Sheffield University's research among declassified records shows that the government continued to investigate reported sightings, and that Defence Intelligence took an unacknowledged interest in them for 50 years. Dr. David Clark has established that it was only in October 2000 that the MOD's Directorate of Scientific and Technical Intelligence finally decided that it no longer needed to see details of any reported UFOs. Dr. Clark's disappointing conclusion for believers, though, is that Britain's X-Files contain no trace of a single alien encounter.
All the investigations and all the documentary evidence that is available from the 1950s right up to present suggests that they've looked at the evidence, they've found, although they can't explain 100%, whatever it is that's been seen, it's not a threat to defence, and that is far as their remit goes.
Has there been a deliberate cover-up by the government?
There has been a cover-up of ignorance. And even though UFOs are regarded as something or nothing, the intelligence agencies are always very, very paranoid about knowledge of their interest in certain subjects leaking out. Because if the public knows that the CIA or the MOD intelligence people are taking a serious interest in the subject of UFOs, that almost de facto means there must be something behind it that the intelligence people know about that is being withheld from the public. And I think that explains this desperation to keep even the knowledge of that interest away from the public gaze.